You are one of 43 clinicians from 14 countries who wrote the original guidelines, which were released nearly a year ago, March 2020, and now there are some updated guidelines. Doctors have, of course, learned a lot about COVID-19 in this year since the pandemic found its way into Western New York. What were the biggest changes and discoveries, at least locally, that that doctors discovered as this pandemic has progressed?
Sure. That's a good question, Michael. Well, one is that besides being clinicians, you also were researchers who helped develop those guidelines. And one of the things that we were fortunate to have is clinical trials on novel agents against COVID-19, including remdesivir, and use of previously used drugs like dexamethasone against COVID-19 that we noticed did help with mortality and improve survival.
Let's talk about remdesivir. It's included on the guidelines. It's recommended for those with a severe case of the disease who are not on ventilation right now. When did that enter the picture during the research? And talk about what was, you know, how doctors discovered its role in potentially treating some patients with severe illness.
So as time went on, we realized more and understood more about COVID-19, including that there's different phases of the disease. There's mild, moderate, and severe disease phases of COVID-19. So there's folks who, and the mass majority of people, are either asymptomatic or have mild disease and stay at home and can be nursed back to health by taking rest and fluids at home. There's individuals who require oxygen support, and they're usually hospitalized in the United States. And then the folks who don't recover from that use of oxygen and may need higher amounts of oxygen or may need to be placed on a mechanical ventilator. And so as we understood more about the disease, we felt that there's different phases of the COVID-19 disease, where you may have a phase where the virus is replicating, and then a phase where immune system of the person is acting against the virus and may be causing more of the damage in the lung and other body organs that's causing the person to require some type of life support measure. And so remdesivir as an antiviral agent looks like it works well in the early phases of disease where you may need low amounts of oxygen. But as your body is mounting an immune response and may be causing some damage to your lungs, it looks like it doesn't work as well. So when we looked at the subgroups of individuals who required mechanical ventilation, starting them remdesivir in those patients didn't seem to help them recover faster. And so looking at that data and looking at the fact that remdesivir is a scarce resource, we wanted to use the remdesivir to have the maximal benefit without introducing any harm or take away from the supply of remdesivir from the people who need it or benefit the most. And that's the rationale for using we're recommending remdesivir for those with severe disease, but not the patients who require mechanical ventilation.
One of the other changes that it's not a light read, but as I was looking through this, the previous recommendation was against in patients with mechanical ventilation against the use of corticosteroids. The new guidelines say, you know, you can use a short course of it. Why was there a change?
Well, actually, in the prior guidance, we did recommend use of corticosteroids. It was just not as strong a recommendation for its use in those who are requiring invasive mechanical ventilation. There's several studies that have came out over the last year, including a large study in the United Kingdom called the UK Recovery Trial that looked at several thousands of patients with and without dexamethasone at different phases of their disease. And we noted that the folks who require mechanical ventilation, dexamethasone helped their recovery and reduced their chance of death. And it kind of makes sense that it would be helpful in that dexamethasone is an anti-inflammatory agent, helps diminishes or slightly suppresses the immune system response. And so if we think that in those who require mechanical ventilation, the phase of COVID that the person is at that time is a phase where the immune system is overactive and may be damaging the lung, then the use of dexamethasone theoretically should help in that kind of scenario. So, and that's what the evidence from that trial and also a pooling of other trial data shows, that dexamethasone helps with the people on the invasive mechanical ventilation. So the difference was, before it was a weaker recommendation, now it's a strong recommendation based on that clinical data.
And then there's also hydroxychloroquine, which the updated guidelines recommend against using. That was a drug that became the focus of a politically charged debate over COVID treatment. Talk about the recommendation against using it, and talk about the importance of updating these guidelines to address, you know, how, you know, sometimes supposed treatments do become more politically charged, and you need to separate the science from other agendas.
It was very interesting, because as I was creating and drafting the first guidelines back in March of 2020, we noticed that there was not that much evidence for hydroxychloroquine. And because clinical trials were ongoing, we said we neither recommend for or against hydroxychloroquine. We just would see and hope that there's clinical trials. But I had family members who were and other friends who were talking to me about the use of hydroxychloroquine, as you mentioned, based on some popular media attention and discussion about it. And so it's important to note the reason why clinical trials of rigorous design is conducted is so that we can really tease out if that drug is making an important and effective change in somebody's survival, somebody's ability to recover. And there were no data out there of hydroxychloroquine in clinical trials and robust design back in the early parts of the epidemic. Now we have looked at the data and realized that yes, hydroxychloroquine, although it theoretically helps knock down the virus in lab data, did not work in humans. And I think that's important to note, that you should wait and look at clinical trial data to help decide on what is beneficial, what is harmful. And what the guidelines is trying to do is try to help provide this in a more understandable way to the clinician at the bedside, a way to navigate all the literature and the data in a more consumable way. Even though, as you mentioned, it's not a light read, it's much easier to look at this information in a condensed version, as opposed to trying to keep up with all the studies, and you're keeping up in the studies in a heavy, likely, incomplete method. So this is a more preferred way of understanding the information. There are still countries out there where hydroxychloroquine is used up very frequently. The other day I looked at an article about Brazil still having hydroxychloroquine being utilized in the country because of political reasons of how the president of Brazil is still advocating for hydroxychloroquine. So it's not just a theoretical risk of adhering to political viewpoints. It's still present now that people may be swayed by non-scientific recommendations.
We just crossed a grim milestone. 500,000 Americans have died as the result of COVID infections. The pandemic is clearly not over. In addition to updating recommendations for treatments, there's updates to recommendations for how clinicians should protect themselves and others as they continue to treat COVID patients. Talk about those updated guidelines published in this new report.
I mean, the benefit of this new guidelines is that there's actually, and we're the beneficiary of new data of clinical trials that shown some agents help with recovery from COVID-19. But as we looked at the past year, the United States had a dismal past year. We lost, as you mentioned, 500,000 people in a disease that other countries were more were able to handle a little bit better. And so going forward, we would have to look at using the best available evidence and data and marshal all our resources to reduce any further deaths and to prevent any more spread of the pandemic, which I think there's definitely political will for. We just have to be more vigilant in the next several months until we are able to reach a unified herd immunity and be able to contain the virus more effectively.
And once we do reach herd immunity, these updated guidelines, I imagine there are probably, if there's not already conversations, maybe thoughts that maybe 1 year from now that we may see even further updated guidelines on how to treat this disease.
Well, I think what likely happened, and we were discussing this in 2022, likely there is a ongoing surviving sepsis campaign on how to deal with patients in the ICU in general. And so these specialized COVID-19 recommendations will probably be folded in to the regular guidelines on how patients in ICU should be managed. So I think, and other experts agree, that the treatment of COVID-19 will be part and parcel of the typical ICU care of a patient. So we will have likely lower amounts of patients with COVID-19 in the hospitals and the ICUs, but it will be something that will be incorporated into the usual practice of clinical medicine.
Over this year, as you drafted or co-wrote the first guidelines and helped with the updates, what would you say you personally have learned the most or was most surprised by with this virus?
Well, I mean, when I was collaborating with these international groups of experts at the beginning, it was the epidemic hadn't reached the United States. So you would hear in these the voices of these experts the concern and distress they were feeling over the phone. And I was somewhat cautiously concerned, and at the same time, obviously, we don't see any patients here in the United States at that time. It was just as early in January, February, and at the same time, I realized how much of the unknown can really cause fear and distress, and even the most intelligent individuals. And then later, I saw that same fear and concern in the United States. And what I realized, the way to handle that unknown was what we normally do for any other concern or any other issue, is to sit down, take a breath, look at the issue, see what is the concrete and identifiable issues behind the new unknown issue. Try to describe it, try to look at evidence that will help you deal with that issue in a scientifically rigorous and robust manner. So what I learned is that you just go back to basics. What you as scientists, what we as a society look at is to look at things and break it down into components that we can understand and try to attack it in a rational manner. And I think that's what I learned the most. It's that trying to deal with any type of new kind of concern or problem is like COVID-19 or any other thing else that you may deal with is the manner is already something that you are understand what to do. It's just that you have to implement it and. It's more the unknown and fear that may paralyze someone. But if you go in and do what you normally do in addressing a problem, you would likely handle it much better than if you kind of panic about the issue.